You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Addison Barnhart, and I represent the appellant, Michael Currier. This appeal is about double jeopardy, collateral estoppel, and what I'm going to call the Hackney Rule after Hackney v. Commonwealth, which is the rule that states that if a multiple charges are brought against a defendant, and one of those charges requires evidence of a prior felony, that that must be separated in a separate trial from the remaining charges where that prior felony would otherwise be prohibited because it's so prejudicial to the defendant for a jury to hear. So there were two jury trials in this case.
Can't the defendant waive that right? It's not a constitutional requirement. It's simply a rule-based requirement under 3A10C. So a defendant can waive the right to have severed trials.
A defendant could waive that right
and
have
thus
separate trials if that's what the defendant wanted to do, I think.
That didn't happen here. It was a consent order.
This was a consent order, yes, sir.
All right, then help me out. Justice McCullough's opinion when he was on the Court of Appeals makes a point of that being dispositive. Why is it not dispositive here?
I guess when I say that you could waive the two trials, that is getting at... That doesn't often happen, and I don't think that really gets to the constitutional question that this case raises, which is double jeopardy. I mean, that's just a defendant choosing to say, I would like to have everything tried at once. And as opposed to what Justice McCullough, and I don't think that was, I'm not sure I understand the question, I'm not sure that was an issue with Justice McCullough's opinion.
Double jeopardy is not a sword, it's a shield. And thus, if the defendant has no choice and gets cornered into a situation where there can be a breach of double jeopardy, there's obviously a remedy. But where there is a choice, the cases that are cited here, at least in his opinion, and the opinion of the Court of Appeals, points out that double jeopardy cannot be used in that way. And my question to you is, I've read your briefs, but I'm still looking for the most persuasive response to that position.
Well, and I apologize, but let me backtrack a little bit on your original question about whether you can waive the requirement that you have separate trials. I think that Hackney said instructs courts that you cannot have the same trial. And that's not the issue here, whether there's an argument between the defendant saying I want one complete trial or I want separate trials. That's just not the issue, but I think that Hackney says you have to separate, and it is a reversible error. It is a serious mistake that the court will make if you do not separate those trials. When it comes to the sword and the shield argument, and the cases of the Court of Appeals said that there is a split, basically, in the states about if you choose to have the separate cases or if you give your consent to the separate cases, what that means in terms of collateral estoppel and double jeopardy. And the cases that the Court of Appeals cited were all clearly sword cases where a defendant is setting up the court to kind of say gotcha afterwards, to say, I'm going to plead guilty to one charge, and then after that, that's going to foreclose you from bringing other charges, so gotcha, you can't hear the other charges.
There's also the demand for separate trials case, the Jeffers case, U.S. Supreme Court, 1977.
Yes, sir. Purely a demand, I believe, on the defendant's part, whereas here, the issue, and I think the record is a little fuzzy here, from the very beginning, it was the Commonwealth saying we have to have separate trials to the defendant, to the defendant's counsel. There is, and I believe the Ohio v. Johnson case, which kind of sets all of this up in terms of whether it's for the consent, whether with the defendant's consent or not, says that if it's purely the defendant trying to separate trials, that's not really where collateral estoppel applies. And because there's no government action, it's just the defendant trying to use it as a sword. Whereas here we have a shield saying we've got one case and you've got to review that case or you've got to review the prior acquittal before you can go on. It's not that the defendant was believed that was just the law. He had to separate. There wasn't any choice. No other choice was offered by the court or the Commonwealth.
Why couldn't he simply say, I don't want to do that? I know I have a right to do it, but I don't want to do that. You're saying a trial court couldn't have said, okay, I accept your waiver. He couldn't consent to a single trial. How could he not? He can consent and waive just about every other right he has. He can't consent and waive that right?
I think any defense counsel would say that, and I think a certain court would be hesitant to do that, because Hackney has very clearly said that courts must separate.
And right. I think that courts must admit admissible relevant evidence, but if it's not objected to, and in particular if it's agreed to, that's not error on appeal.
I understand, yes, sir. The issue of consent here, and I guess what I refer to in my brief is what the Court of Appeals sets up a new rule that says that if you do consent to separate trials, then you waive your constitutional rights to double jeopardy. And so that sets up this Hobson's choice, meaning that you have no, the defendant really has no good choice at all. Either to go forward with one trial where there's prejudicial evidence offered against him, and or waive your constitutional rights to double jeopardy and to collateral estoppel, which happens in a variety of civil and criminal cases. And so I don't think that the Hobson's choice is a good policy. The better policy, at least in my mind, would be if you have two trials and you have a final judgment and one, and it's an acquittal, like in this case, then let's just review and see what facts were decided.
Well, that would be collateral estoppel, but that's different from double jeopardy merger bar. Your first argument, double jeopardy, is no, I got an acquittal. Game over. I don't have to find any. I don't have to pick apart any of the facts of the prior case. And that's what the Court of Appeals addressed in terms of, yeah, but you agreed to that, and you can't have it both ways. The Hobson's choice is actually inverted. But collateral estoppel is no, there was an essential fact found in the first trial, and that essential fact is a necessary essential fact to the second severed proceeding. Why don't you turn your attention to that and explain why that's necessarily true here?
Well, I guess, if I understand the question correctly, and where I would go with that is, there are, consent isn't just the only issue when it comes to collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel is used in many different types of cases, in terms of when there is a misdemeanor and a felony brought by the defendant, and one of those cases is tried in the general district court, the misdemeanor, and that can prevent the Commonwealth from going forward on the felony if the fact is decided, and that fact is essential to the felony in the second case. And the same happens with the mistrial. If there's an acquittal, all in the same trial, if there's an acquittal and a mistrial, then the mistrial is, the acquittal can prevent the Commonwealth from bringing it again.
I'm with you, but why, getting to your case, though, why isn't it possible for the first fact finder to have concluded, you know what, I'm certain that the defendant possessed the firearms at the river, but I'm not certain, beyond a reasonable doubt, he actually possessed them in the victim's home, and I don't believe Wood 100%, I believe him 0.5%. I mean, that's possible, isn't it? Because clearly there was evidence of him possessing the weapons in the safe at the time of the river.
There was evidence of that, but that was, and that was, well, the evidence in the cases were exactly the same in the first and the second trial. It was the same evidence and the same argument used in both trials. And the defendant, I think it's important to point out, did not testify, did not put on any evidence. So the issue wasn't a parsing of, like the Commonwealth would have, a parsing of what was the intent. I mean, maybe they could have had the intent, could have been there, but not had the intent to steal it. None of that really applies. What matters is, was Mr. Currier there? Was he present? Was he involved in these crimes? And because that's all that we really have. That's all that the Commonwealth argued in the first trial. If you find that he was there, or took part in any part of this crime, then he's guilty. And by the jury's acquittal, they found that he was not present and couldn't be found. So I don't think that you can really parse the evidence and the facts in this case, because you have the factual issue alone is presence. And that's just like what happened in the Ash case to begin with. I mean, you look at this with what Ash tells you with realism and rationality. You can't, you've got to just say it kind of like how I just described it. It wasn't about intent or did they break or enter. It was he there or not? And you know, a collateral estoppel and the course of the cases.
But why does it matter if he was in the home at all? in trial number two. Why wouldn't it be enough to say he possessed the weapons at a later time?
Well, I think that is possible. I believe it is possible for the Commonwealth to put on a strange, short sort of case about the person who actually committed these crimes testifying that the gun was handed to Mr. Currier, and then nothing before that. I mean, because otherwise you would have evidence that should be precluded, his presence at the burglary and stealing the gun safe. I can't really see how that would work. But I think it is possible that you could have a second trial as long as you really, as long as you could really make it so small and kind of strange. But the jury instructions in the first trial was talked about a concert of action. I mean, the crime happened at the house, but then it continued into the county, and it continued for a long period of time. So it's all part of the same thing, really, what I would say to that. The Court of Appeals' rule, they really rely significantly on the lack of prosecutorial abuse or overreach and the lack of oppression that a defendant might experience. The principles of double jeopardy is to prevent prosecutorial abuse and to protect the defendant from oppression. And that wasn't, and so the Court of Appeals said that's not present in a Hackney case where you have to separate it and you can argue it's for the defendant's benefit. But that is not the sole purpose of double jeopardy and collateral estoppel. Overreach and oppression is maybe the main part of it. Maybe that's the part of double jeopardy that we all think of as soon as we hear those words. But the Supreme Court in the Yeager versus the United States case said that there's a second purpose of the double jeopardy clause, and that's the collateral estoppel. That is the respect of the final judgment that was made. And so in this case, you have a final judgment in the first case that was an acquittal. And rather than just go right along and try a new one based on what I call a de novo second trial or for the Commonwealth, so they get a dry run the first time, and they would always have this under the Court of Appeals rule, you simply have that review, and defendants don't often win these cases. You know, if the defendant, I think, testifies, if there's a self-defense argument, if there is if there's conflicting evidence, if there's multiple crimes, you really can't tell much from a general verdict what was decided. And so Ash would apply, but the defendant would likely lose. In this case, there is none of that. There's no testimony by the defendant. There's simply he wasn't there, and so you can't go on to the second case. Because he would win the Ash argument, and we're asking the court to apply Ash. That should be the case. That should always be applied. I think that the Constitution and the Double Jeopardy Clause errs on the side of defendants here. You don't try and just say, well, it's be unfair for the Commonwealth. You really look and see what the Constitution does and what collateral estoppel does for the defendant. And after you apply Ash, either the case goes on or it doesn't. And so we're asking this court to always apply Ash. And that to apply Ash specifically in this case, and to rule that the second trial should have been prohibited, and that Mr. Currier should be released from jail, and that it should have never happened. I guess I'm asked to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. The first question I'd like to address is, can Hackney be waived? The answer here is clearly yes. Hackney does not say it is automatically reversible error to try a felon in possession charge with other charges that do not involve proof of a felony. Hackney says it's reversible error if the defendant moves for severance and the severance is not granted. Those are very different.
And am I right? The Supreme Court of Virginia has never reviewed Hackney. And there's no Supreme Court precedent on point. And we're assuming arguendo that holding that Hackney adopted in 1998 is agreeable with us.
That is correct. Hackney itself relies on Long and Johnson, which are also Court of Appeals cases.
But we've been consistent about waiver of constitutional rights. It certainly sounds like it would be agreeable with us.
Absolutely, and the Supreme Court cases, the U.S. Supreme Court cases that were mentioned as well, Ohio v. Johnson, Jeffers, also talk about specifically waiving double jeopardy protection. The fact that the defendant had a choice to make about whether or not to waive the protections of Hackney doesn't mean he didn't consent and doesn't mean he did not, in fact, make that choice. I'd also like to touch briefly on one of the last things counsel for Mr. Currier said, which was that a second trial should have been prohibited. That was not the assignment of error in the Court of Appeals. That is not the remedy that was requested. What was requested was that the evidence be precluded. And I believe that is the issue before this court, whether evidence of what happened at the house, the burglary and larceny evidence, should have been precluded, not whether the second trial should have been prohibited completely. Now, first, I'd like to touch very briefly on the Rice issue, that there was no prior proceeding. This was the original issue that the circuit court seemed to think about, but not ultimately rule on. However, implicit in collateral estoppel is that there had to be some sort of prior proceeding. And in this case, there wasn't. The case law is clear that it is a simultaneous proceeding if it is begun at the same time, regardless of when it is resolved. And all these indictments were at the same time. Therefore, they are simultaneous. We have over 20 years of, again, Court of Appeals, not this court's decision, saying so. However, this court could reject the collateral estoppel analysis solely on that issue, that there is no true prior proceeding here. They were simultaneously brought, and they were just severed for the defendant's benefit.
In that regard, this case looks an awful lot like a premature habeas.
I understand. Yes, Your Honor. That is a possibility. But ultimately, going to the ruling that the circuit court did make and Judge McCullough's decision in the Court of Appeals, is that it was severed at the defendant's request for the defendant's benefit. And the defendant's argument against this relies on facts outside the record, where he essentially says, well, it's not in the record. The Commonwealth told me this had to be severed. This is, I guess, the potential habeas issue, Your Honor. But I would note that in the Court of Appeals brief, before this became an issue, at page 588 going on to 589 of the record, the defendant stated within his brief that it was severed by consent. And now he's arguing with things that are not in the record that it is he was, in fact, tricked into some sort of severance. A quick read of Hackney shows that the defendant's claim that he had to sever is wrong and that he had other options. You can't choose one strategy at trial and then disavow that strategy on appeal in an attempt to get a reversal.
Now, by the way, the fact that I said it looks like a premature habeas does not indicate that I think it would be a successful habeas, because there's all kinds of reasons why people might not want to sever the trials.
Absolutely.
There are a number of us here on the bench who are trial judges. I can recite any number of occasions where I asked counsel, I told them, you have a right to sever these. He said, we know. We don't want to. We have our reasons. And they did.
Correct. And habeas would, of course, require some sort of prejudice showing, right, which I don't think under these facts would be possible. As I said earlier, double jeopardy can be waived, and I believe it was in this case. However, even if collateral estoppel were applied to this case, it simply would not preclude the evidence that came into the second trial. The defendant was required to establish that the jury verdict necessarily precluded the defendant from ever possessing these firearms. And instead, what is being argued is that the sole issue at trial one was identification, and that the jury verdict necessarily decided the defendant was not present at the Garrison's home. There's simply no way to know if that's what the jury based their decision on. The jury was specifically instructed by the court in the first trial that presence alone was not sufficient to convict. So there could have been many reasons for why they acquitted, including that he did not have the specific intent necessary for burglary or grand larceny, or that they just simply weren't sure that Wood was credible enough.
Unless I've misunderstood opposing counsel, and he'll correct me in rebuttal, I hope, if I'm wrong, the evidence was sufficient in the severed second proceeding to find possession by the defendant outside the home.
Well, that is certainly the Commonwealth's argument, that regardless of what happened in the home, outside of the home, there was additional...
Well, that's the way collateral estoppel works under Ash and under every other iteration of the doctrine. It's got to be a necessary fact that could not have not been found.
Correct. And the evidence was not, in fact, identical at the second trial. At the second trial, the DNA evidence of the defendant's cigarette butt that was in the truck bed with the insulation from the safe, and also the details about what exactly he did handling the gun at the creek. Both of those were additional evidence that was at the second trial that established that regardless of whether he participated knowingly in the burglary and the grand larceny, or was even present at the grand larceny, he was later present with the guns and possessed them. So it's sufficient completely outside of whether or not he participated in the burglary. And finally, even if collateral estoppel had applied here, collateral estoppel is a very narrow preclusion. And based on the cases I cited, the evidence that was allowed in here about him participating in the burglary and the grand larceny would have still been allowed in. Ultimately, or rather, it's the ultimate finding that's generally precluded in collateral estoppel, such as saying someone was intoxicated during a car accident, as opposed to merely showing that they had been drinking before a car accident. So the evidence here followed that very fine line of what could have been precluded, and there was no improper evidence admitted in the trial in the second trial. If there are no questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Thank you. I do want to push back a little bit on this idea that the Court of Appeals and the Commonwealth have said that the defendant requested second trials. Absolutely not the case. There was no. I take a request as an affirmative. Can I please do this? There was none of that in this case. It was simply following the Commonwealth saying, Hackman, read Hackman. We have to have two trials. My client did not want to have two trials, but it was. We felt like that was the rule, and we were told it was reversible error not to.
You were trial counsel?
I was, yes, sir.
Your client did not want two trials?
He didn't, no.
He
was incarcerated for almost a year before we even got to the first trial. There were multiple trials before this, and that's the problem with the record here. There was
Can I interrupt for a second? At page 598 and 599, your brief to Judge McCullough's panel is, quote, by agreement between the Commonwealth and Mr. Currier, the Circuit Court severed Mr. Currier's charges and scheduled one trial for breaking and entering and grand larceny charges and another trial for the felon in possession of a firearm charge. The representation to the court has been it was by agreement.
Which I would argue is not the same thing as a defendant's request. I think there is government action there. The government is agreeing to the same thing. The government, so that's where I would draw the difference between this case and the other cases like Jeffers and Ohio v. Johnson. See, my time is up.
All right, thank you very much. Call the next case.